And suddenly you realize you're in charge of this biggest radio station in the world. We had thought when commercial radio started, they'd be giving away a Cortina every breakfast time. My wife and I were dragging them out of the water and laying them on the bank on the side there. They were sobbing.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Johnny Beerling.
Dad was a huge fan of radio, and that's really, I suppose, why I got into it, because he used to build his own sets, you know. From, he would wind coils and transformers and things, so I was always fascinated by that. And we lived in a small village down in Kent where there wasn't even very much mains electricity. It was that bad, and we used to have to cycle to the nearby village of Ash to get the accumulators recharged. So you had an HC battery and then an accumulator to run the radio sets. And I can even remember cycling to Ash. I mean, it must have been four or five then, which would make it about 1940-42.
All we know is that we are happy to welcome that man again.
The one I can remember more than any other, I think, was Itmar. It's That Man Again. You know, this was a huge favourite during the war, and he kept the nation's morale up. And he died very suddenly. I think it was a heart attack or a stroke. And I can remember the whole country being heartbroken about this, and I actually cried.
It's That Man Again.
Yeah, so when you did national service, it wasn't quite as bad as people make out. They did ask you what you were interested in, and I always wanted to fly. You know, I thought that would be fantastic, but unfortunately, I didn't pass all the aptitude tests for that. So what else would you like to do? I said, well, Dad was always interested in radio. I'm going to spend 2 years in the Air Force. I'll learn about radio. So they taught me to be a ground wireless fitter. That took best part of 9 months down at Compton Bassett in Wiltshire in Calne. And I learnt all the ins and outs of the 1509 transmitter and the, I can't remember all the other numbers, but the various radios and how to repair them and how they worked. And then I got posted, and I was posted to Aden in the Middle East, which is incredibly hot. So hot, the working day is from 7 in the morning till lunchtime, then you get the afternoon free. And I'd been there about a couple of months, I suppose. My main job seemed to be repairing the two-way radios that the Aden Protectorate levies had on the back of their camels, and they would fall off the camel and they'd bring them to us to repair. And I was working in the control tower repairing these sets, and the boss sent for me and he said, look, there's a radio station here in Aden, AFBA, which was jointly financed by the British Petroleum Refinery, I think it was, and the Air Force. And the Air Force ran it for the benefit of the families that were there and the troops. This was before the days of British Forces broadcasting. And so he said, look, the technician that was running it before is going home. Would you like the job? And I thought, my God, what, this is falling on your feet. So I said, yes, please. He said, there's only one snag. You have to get up at 0500 and open up at 6, and you broadcast from 6 till 8. And you'll have to do the broadcasting. You do the early morning music show. And then from 8 till 8.30, we relay the General Overseas Service of the BBC, and then we shut down at 8.30.
You're tuned to the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
So that was fine. We started off doing this, and I'd always fancied myself as a budding David Jacobs or Johnny Beerling. I had no idea, really, what it was about, but I thought, well, it's quite fun, this disc jockey lark. So I'd get up and turn the transmitter on, and there was one other member of staff who was the studio manager stroke librarian. We used to do this early morning broadcast, and so whilst I was doing all of this, a chap came to Aden. His name was Peter West, not the famous one. He was something to do with external broadcasting transmitters, and he said, very nice to meet you. I'm Peter West, and I have to check on the reception of the General Overseas Service. Can you show me what sort of aerials you use to pick us up and how you relay us and what have you? And would you like to have lunch? I said, lunch? My God, nobody's ever asked me to lunch. I was about 18 at the time. So he took me to the Rock Hotel and we had lunch. And I said, you know, I was going to be a school teacher, but I'd really like to work for the BBC. Oh, don't worry about that, old chap. I'll put a word in for you when I get back, you see. So when we came back, in those days, the BBC ran a show called The Radio Show at Earl's Court. And Dad and I, being fans, went along to this, and there was an information bureau there, and I went up, and I'd been demobbed by this time, obviously, and I said, excuse me, I'm supposed to be having a job with the BBC. Oh, really? Well, we'll send you for an interview. So I went across and saw these people, and they said, do know Ohm's law, and I remembered V equals IR and one or two other things from the days of the training. Yes, that's it, you're in, you'll be a technical operator. Well, I was so naive, you know, I thought a technical operator was a man who operated the equipment in studios. Wouldn't that be good? I thought, yeah, that's my cup of tea. And I found out that TOs really sat there polishing the jacks, double enders, and measuring noise levels in studios and monitoring broadcasts running through the control room in Bulgarian or Albanian. And I thought, that's not really my cup of tea. I want to be a studio operator. Ah, there's a problem there, because these people are called studio managers, and you have to have a degree in sociology or some useless subject and be terribly artistic, and you're just an oik engineer, you see. What do you know about fading music and so on? Somebody had enough foresight to allow about six of us TOs to apply and become studio managers, and we had everything was done by selection board. In those days, when you joined the BBC, you had a contract, you had a job for life. The general's baton was in your back pocket. So you could apply for any job, and providing you could convince a selection board, then you got the job. So I got trained as a studio manager and went to Evesham in Worcestershire, where the BBC had a training school, and we learned how to edit tape and balance sound and play records and do all the other things and rattle the teacups on Mrs. Dale's diary and so on.
Mrs. Dale's Diary, a recording of the daily happenings in the life of a doctor's wife.
And that was wonderful training for 3 months. I just got married then, so I wasn't very keen on leaving my new wife for 3 months, but it was very good. It was good fun, and we did learn a lot. And it gave me a very useful background, because I'd done the engineering side of the BBC for a couple of years, and then I became a studio manager. And so that was really the start of it, and I found myself working on those schools programs, you know, which was very interesting, again, in meeting these people that I'd listened to when I'd been at junior school.
Think of the floor as a large white sheet of paper, and yourself as the pencil, drawing shapes as you march.
I used to help do the news a lot. Studios 3G and 3F, which were in Egton House then, that was where the newsroom was in those days. And people like John Snagg, Andrew Timothy, Robin Boyle, Jimmy Kingsbury. They were all sort of famous announcers who doubled up as announcers and newsreaders as well, you see. So I met all of those type of people in those days.
And this is Albert Jones calling Radio Newsreel from Berlin. This visit, with its huge crowds, drives around the city and receptions, has been very much Mr. Robert Kennedy's show.
The Radio Newsreel, that was an interesting program, because in those days, reports from foreign correspondents were cut onto acetate discs, 78 acetate discs, and I'd done that as a TO. If you're doing a program like Radio Newsreel, where you may have 20 or 30 inserts in half an hour, that's really some going. And we used to smoke, so you're trying to light a cigarette, play the inserts in, find the right places. I think Mrs. Dale's Diary was on tape. I can remember once, when I was still a technical operator, the height of my ambition was to sit in the continuity studio where the announcer made the linking announcements, and I was allowed to start the tape of Mrs. Dale's Diary. To do a programme like Housewife's Choice, it was very complicated. You had to, first of all, sort through the postcards to find the records that you wanted, and then you went to the gramophone library and looked up the records and timed them. And in the meantime, you'd give the postcards to the presenter, who would, in longhand, write a script for every link.
And round the corner I am. Good morning. It's funny how reticent some people are to give names, whereas others literally fill their postcards with full details of 200 or 300 people they'd like mentioned.
This would then be brought back in, typed up, and then you would go to the studio at about 6 in the morning and do a full rehearsal of everything, the speech links, playing the records in full, adjusting the timings, adjusting each link as if it were a polished talk. And then you would stop and have a continental breakfast, perhaps a croissant and a cup of orange juice and a cup of coffee. And then you would do the programme again from 9 till 9:55, when everything stopped for a story, a hymn and a prayer, you see, 5 minutes of religion for the next programme at 10 o'clock. So I did this one morning with Gilbert Harding, and as we were leaving, he'd taken quite a shine to me. He said, "Very nice to have you again, young man. Pleased to see you tomorrow. And to you, good day, ma'am," to Esther Farmer, poor old producer. So there we are. I was very happy. I never had ambitions to be on, you know, being a studio manager. I was in my element. I was working with all these people that I knew. I was playing the records for Pete Murray and David Jacobs and Alan Freeman, not off, and so on. And it was a wonderful time. And I was very, very interested in popular music. I mean, I had gone into it because, apart from my love of radio, I'd always had a love of big bands. And I used to go to the Coronation Ballroom in Ramsgate and sit and listen to Ted Heath. It's just wonderful when Ted had Dennis Slotis and Lita Rosa. I remember you. So I really always loved having big bands, and I loved popular music, so I gravitated towards working on programmes produced by people like Derek Chinnery and Teddy Warwick. And because everything was done on a stopwatch, you see, you have to understand that in those days there was no self-operation, self-op as we call it. A studio manager played the records, an assistant studio manager, somebody else mixed the sound, and the DJ sat in a glass box with his script, and you had a copy of the script, and, you know, Alan would work off a stopwatch.
First time on the charts this week, and a top 10 breakthrough on that number 8 rung for Manfred Mann's Doo-Wah Diddy Diddy, and Jim, down.
I'd then become, by that time, I'd stopped being a studio manager and I'd applied for and become a producer and gramophone department. This was run by a formidable lady called Anna Instone. She and her husband, Julian Herbage, presented a music magazine programme on the third programme in the mornings. I mean, we're still talking about the Days of the Light programme now. Anyway, Anna was in charge of gramophone department and her deputy was a man called Dougie Lawrence. First programme I ever did as a producer was Music from the Continent. Here we were, half an hour to fill here, 6:30 till 7 on the BBC Home Service. And it was mostly non-needle time. You had to use records out of the BBC library. And I discovered a man called Rudi Knabel. He was a German zither player who was fantastic. And I actually met him years later at an EBU function in Munich when we were on the lake. And he was playing the zither in the corner. I started a programme called Where It's At with the notorious Chris Denning. In fact, one of the best editions of Where It's At was before Radio 1 started, because Kenny was very friendly with John Lennon and had got himself into the studio at Abbey Road to talk through with the Beatles every track of Sgt. Pepper. And we put together an hour-long feature, which was just brilliant, you know, because that record came out, I think, in June 67. But anyway, Where It's At carried on Radio 1. Kenny Everett used to do bits for us, and Jonathan King used to do bits for us. Jonathan's still a friend of mine. But anyway, that's by the by. But this programme, Where It's At, I modelled it very much on the pirate style. Kenny used to make up cod commercials for us.
Tea is lovely, tea's refreshing, tea is such a pleasant drink. That's why I say, Polly, put the kettle on and let's all...
Sam Cooke there, Revive 45, remember it, and that's called Chain Gang. And I just noticed in the other studio just now, I was just having a look, and I noticed we've got a new LP. No, not long-playing record, Large Pimple.
Perhaps not many people know, I was the only person from the BBC that ever went out to have a look at Radio London for myself. This is interesting, I must see how this works. People thought I'd gone to recruit DJs, I didn't actually. So we went off on this boat, and I met them all, you know, Dave Lee Travis, Keith Skews, John Peel was there, Tony Blackburn. And it was a very, very interesting trip, and Kenny was very keen to show me how it all worked about self-op and what have you. And really, there was nobody in management listening to what was going on, except maybe back in the office in London. So it was a very free and easy atmosphere, and I thought, this sort of authoritarian way of running the BBC, it can't work. We've got to have studios like that. The only place in the BBC in those days where an announcer could play records was in the continuity studios. And that's why to this day they still talk about going to the cons, because we had to take continuity studios and modify them and put cartridge. We didn't even have cartridge machines in the BBC. I brought the first two in for a programme called European Pop Jury. So we had to have jingle machines, cartridge machines, and we had to have Gates turntables. Kenny was very much driving this because he knew.
Here's news. Starting in September, the BBC begins a new service for fans of popular music. There'll be light. And then there's pop.
We're talking Ben with now on the high.
And then there's always... Oh, excuse me. This is how Radio 247 will work.
Tony had been quite canny. He'd come ashore 6 months or so before the pirates had closed down or been closed down by the Marine Offences Act. So he had been doing midday spin and he and I knew each other.
This afternoon's weather, showery in most places, but there'll be some bright intervals in northern Britain. Another bright interval right now with Tony Blackburn.
Thank you very much, and back to the music with Pink Floyd.
Yeah, I think they couldn't have had a lot of enthusiasm for it because, I mean, what did they give us? A transmitter on 247 metres, which was terrible. It was nearly as bad as Luxembourg in the sense that in daytime you could hear it over most of the country, but after it got dark in the evenings in the winter, it was practically inaudible to half the country. So that was one handicap. There were lots of dummy runs, you know, of different programmes, and Tony had very clear ideas on what he wanted to do. We didn't know about such things as playlists, you know, and Tony said, well, we have to develop a playlist. And his idea was lots of familiar music and lots of familiar oldies and maybe one or two new ones. And with a bit of luck, he could become as well known as Radio 1. So it was always Tony Blackburn on Radio 1 and, you know, 10 Radio 1 minutes past the Tony Blackburn show.
The voice of Radio 1. Just... Music. Too much.
And good morning, everyone. Welcome to the exciting new sound of Radio 1.
I was there in the studio. You wouldn't see it if you see the film now. It looks as if Robin Scott was the only person there. I believe, and Tony and I disagree about this, Tony thinks he filmed it the day before. I thought they refilmed it again afterwards. But anyway, somehow that was the film that you always see is one that was made up to look good, so it wasn't there. But there was a lot of nervous tension, of course there was. It was not every day you launch a new network on the BBC, but Tony was very good and very slick. Don't forget he'd been doing 6 months at least of midday spin, so he was familiar with the BBC ways of working. But I realised after 2 weeks, I was living about 40 miles out in the middle of Kent at this time, and getting up in the middle of the night and driving up, I said, Tony doesn't need a producer. I'll listen to the show at home, then I'll go to London and see him and we'll do an inquest about the next day's programme. So after 2 weeks, I stopped travelling to the studio and left it to Tony. I don't know, a year or so later, Tim Blackmore took over as producer. But then, I suppose one of the most significant figures to come into my life was Simon Dee, who turned up in my office one day and said, how would I go about getting a job on Radio 1? I took him across the road to the Dover Castle pub and the back of IBC Studios in Portland Street, Portland Place, and we had a chat and I put his name forward and he was chosen for Midday Spin.
You're tuned to Radio Caroline on 199, your all-day music station.
Well, Simon, of course, had started Radio Caroline for Ronan O'Reilly and had become very well known. And he was a very confident young man, to put it politely, and he thought he knew everything. So he was pleased to get on Radio 1, and it wasn't long before he got a programme called Music to Midnight. And that was very much in the style of the Parkinson television show, in that we would have guests in the studio, perhaps a jazz trio or quartet playing live in the studio, and they would laugh at his jokes as he was going along. And we did it in a studio called S1 in the sub-basement of Broadcasting House. So we used to do that programme, Music to Midnight. And Simon was very good at it, but he moved on into television and became bigger and bigger, and did something of a Chris Evans in the sense that he was so big that he started to make impossible demands of the production, and he went from BBC to ITV, where I heard that he'd made demands about, I want so-and-so on my show tonight or I'm not going to do it. And they called his bluff and said, OK, we'll get Pete Murray to do it this week. And Simon disappeared almost overnight after that and finished up driving a bus in Reading. Very sad. But he was all right. I got on. Carl Henty Dodd, I think, was his real name. Yeah. So Music to Midnight. And then that was taken over by John Dunn, the late John Dunn, who was a great presenter. And I can remember when I was put in charge of this, I was attached from Gramophone Department to Popular Music Department. They were the people who made recordings in our own studios and mixed them with records. and was told I could produce music to midnight. And I said, who can I book? Well, book who you like, you've got a budget. So I said, can I book Ted Heath? And can you imagine the thrill to me, having grown up? Jeff Owen was the executive producer, and he said, you can book Ted Heath if you book Eric Winston on alternate weeks. I don't know whether he had some deal going or what it was, but anyway. So I would record Eric Winston and I would record Ted Heath, and the old man would, you know, sit in his house and we'd go through all the books and work out which songs we wanted and then have the band play them and produce. And I've still got some of those recordings and they sound absolutely fabulous, you know. They really do. It's 40 years ago now, nearly. It was. And we used to record lots of singers with little small groups. I mean, you had a budget and you had to live. So if you spend all your budget on a big band, one of the people we used was a Dutch guitarist called Wout Steenhuis, and he worked like Les Paul. He could do multi-tracking, so he was very cheap because you paid him one musician fee and you got perhaps got four songs recorded for this. Most sessions in the BBC were 3.5 hours, and in that time you were expected to record, you know, at least four songs finished, ready for transmission. It was Kenny that was responsible for the jingles on Radio 1. He and I went to lunch with Robin Scott, and I remember Kenny saying, well, if you want your new Radio 1 to sound anything like the Pirates, you've got to get the same jingles. And the jingles are made by a company called Promotions and Merchandisers, PAMS, in Dallas. Oh, said Robin. And he sent Derek Chinnery to Dallas to make the first recordings with Bill Meeks of PAMS, and that was in the early days. It wasn't until 1976, years later, when I was in a position to make the jingles, that I got a company called JAM, John Wolfert's company, because John had worked for Bill Meeks and he just made jingles that were so good that he got the contract and worked for me for something like 17 years. Kenny had a lot to do with the launch of Radio 1, with the jingles, with the layout of the studios. But also he made a lot of the promotional jingles, you know, because he would take a backing track, write some words to it, and then overdub it several times, bouncing to and fro on old mono machines with no noise reduction until he got a little choir. So music at morning time, music at night time, and music whenever you feel it's the right time to switch on your radio and tune to the sound of. That was the style of working, and he was just so creative, because what Kenny put between the records was as entertaining as the records themselves, and there are very few disc jockeys that can do that. The disc jockeys who can enthuse and love the music, like the late Roger Scott, who I thought was terrific. And then there are the types that like to sell themselves more than they sell the music. Kenny was very impatient with the BBC structures, and he was told by his contract he wasn't to speak without a press officer present to the press, but he couldn't button his lip. If you remember the meeting with Mrs. Thatcher in Wembley Stadium when he said he'd told her to bomb Russia. And then on Radio London, the ship, he had coughed his way through the cigarette commercial.
Strike it rich with Richmond.
Switch to Richmond, just 4 and 3 for 20.
And I think there was a religious program sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God, and he'd rather taken the mickey out of that, and the sponsor had asked that he be fired from it. So he had a history of somewhat being somewhat rebellious, but it was in a cheeky sort of way. And the background to his sacking, I mean, the culmination was the fact that he made some comments about the Minister of Transport's wife passing her advanced driving test by bunging a fiver into the hand of the examiner. And it was for that reason that Ian Trethewan said, well, that's the last straw, because there had been a history of his making critical remarks about the fact the BBC couldn't play all records and about the Musicians' Union and the limits on needle time that we had to put up with. And Kenny, of course, didn't know that we were in the middle of fairly delicate negotiations with the BPI, British Phonographic Institute, and so Kenny had sort of broken all the rules and embarrassed us, and I stuck my head above the parapet. I wasn't actually Kenny's producer at the time, but I was a fairly close friend. And I wrote to Ian Trethewan protesting strongly that this would diminish the BBC in the eyes of the listeners, but he wouldn't have it. So that was it. He was out.
Kenny passed because she crammed a fiver in his hand. I know these people. And now, where were we?
I was in the train with Noel going to Weymouth. We were going to do, I had started by this time a programme called Radio 1 Club, which grew out of a programme called Pop In. Pop In was in the days of the light programme. I think it was a 45-minute programme or an hour at lunchtime with Keith Fordyce, where you literally the audience could pop into the Regent, Lower Regent Street studio called Paris. And we would play records and we would interview pop guests and play the latest records. So I came up with the idea of Radio 1 Club, of virtually making it a club which members could get in free, and we would do it in different parts of the country in different locations with a disc jockey, with a live band playing and various guests turning up. So Noel Edmonds had been doing that, and we were travelling down to Weymouth. Must have just had early days of mobile phones. Noel took a phone call, and it was Mark White, who was head of Radio 1. And he said, Kenny Everett's going, we want you to take it over. Noel was somewhat flabbergasted. He said, to me, you know, just the two of us in the train travelling down, I don't know if I could handle this. And I said, well, you can. You know, you've got to have the confidence in what you've done and take it and make it your own. You know, it's a challenge. Bigger challenge is Paul Gambaccini replacing Tony Blackburn.
Package from George Harrison. If you spin over My Sweet Lord, you get What Is Life, and if you go to the monetary extent of buying the triple album set, you can listen to it.
I think by then I was, must have been about 72, I was executive producer by then, and I've always had sort of promotional ideas. That was my sort of flair in a way, because I was on holiday down in France and I saw all these French campers taking their aluminium chairs after their evening meal, and I thought, oh, I'll follow them, what are they doing? And they were sitting in front of a big caravan. I think it was either Radio Monte Carlo or Radio Luxembourg, I don't know, but they had this big sort of caravan with a side that opened and a stage, and they're doing a programme which I can only compare to Sunday night at the London Palladium on the radio. I thought that would be really good if we could do Radio 1 like that, because the Radio 1 Club had fallen out of favour because it was a lunchtime programme and so many kids were skiving off school and taking their lunch breaks extended at the Radio 1 Club that Ed Masters were writing to complain to the BBC. So we took that off and we needed a replacement. And I thought if we could have a show that we could travel around the beaches and do it rather like the French style, that would be quite successful. Make allowances for the weather. And so I came back and floated the idea to Derek Chinnery. And he said, well, you can go and research it and see what you can find out. And I started to make inquiries within the BBC, and nobody had such a vehicle. And the BBC in those days had regional centres, Bristol, Birmingham, Manchester, Glasgow, Belfast. So we had a meeting of producers, and the producer from the BBC in Bristol was a chap called Brian Patton. And Brian said, I know a man who's John Miles. He's the manager of Ed Cutler and the Wurzels, and he's got a pantechnicon of a side that opens, and they do it at country fairs. They do that ooh-ah-ooh-ah nonsense. I said, oh, we'll go and see John then. And we went to see him and literally sketched out on a cigarette packet almost in John's living room. He said, well, that's a good ideal, because he's a good old Bristol boy. He said, I haven't got the vehicle anymore, but my brother Tony's a coach builder. We could build you something and we could rent it to the BBC. We could tow it with a Range Rover. How would that be? I said, well, sounds a good idea. How much? £100 a day, including Tony's services. So that was the start of it. We built the first one. We tested it out in a hangar down in somewhere in Bristol. It all seemed to work all right, and we all cleared off back to London, and poor old Tony Miles was left trying to pack. The stage panels were fairly heavy steel frames. He packed them all inside the caravan, and then of course we had to fit a continuity type desk, put signage on it and everything else. Unfortunately, Tony didn't have much experience of towing caravans, so when he drove down the road, the thing developed a terrible wobble. He was almost in tears because he had to get it to Newquay by the start of the show, 1973. What I thought was, in my mind, the big problem for Radio 1 was that it would be thought of by people living up in the north of England or in other parts of the country as that station down there in London. And I thought, we need to get out and about and meet people, you know. And so meeting people on holiday is the best thing we could do. So my plan was in 6 weeks to go around the entire coastline of the UK, including Northern Ireland, which was very ambitious. But it was clearly a success right from the beginning. I mean, we didn't have huge crowds and it was a fairly small caravan, but it worked all right. And after a couple of years, everybody had faith in it. And of course, you start to get union problems. Why are these non-BBC people, like John Miles, driving a vehicle with BBC equipment in it? It should be driven by our people. Well, then you have to make me a vehicle. So eventually you make the case in the BBC and argue, and eventually somebody builds you one. And that's how that happened. And at the same time, I had got a little bit of sponsorship out of BBC Records. I said, you can sell your records out of the back of the caravan, and we'll sell a few souvenir T-shirts, you see. So Freeman would be broadcasting from the front, and there's a stable door in the side where people could come and collect their BBC records. So a chap called Tony Fish had been working at Radio 1, making promotions and trailers and what have you, and he came up with the idea of the Radio 1 Goodie Mobile, which was rather a nice name for it. So we finished up with Tony Miles and his staff running the Goodie Mobile, and then the BBC engineer and drivers driving the roadshow vehicle itself. And they were all dressed up in the same livery, you know, so it was good fun. And then the thing grew and grew. And I mean, it's amazing, really. I think the show ran for something like 27 years.
Good morning, Zone.
Morning,
we're all ready and raring to go out here.
How many people have you got today? It must have topped the 10 million mark.
Well, speaks for itself, doesn't it? See you tomorrow, Zone.
See you, bye.
Today, live from St. George's Park in York.
There's an interesting story about the livery, because Noel Edmonds and then Mike Smith had got us involved in motor racing, and we found that was good promotion. It was sort of an association between the fans of popular music and the fans of motor racing, and I'd noticed that motor racing teams all dressed up in distinctive styles. They all had anoraks that bore the name of the company that was sponsoring them, so I thought we could have Radio 1 gear like this. We could call what people rudely called the ice cream jackets, red, white and blue jackets with the logo on the background and the name on. And of course they got very proud of it once they got their own names on them. So they were sort of fighting for this. So it became the Radio 1 uniform, a Radio 1 t-shirt, a Radio 1 jacket and a pair of blue jeans. So that's how that grew up. I mean, it was very much inspired by the motor racing, because we had done promotional days in conjunction with some forward-thinking managers who own Brands Hatch, Mallory Park and Snetterton and Alton Park up in Cheshire. And we put on what we called Radio 1 Fun Days, where we would do the roadshow, but we'd also have a number of pop personalities, either artists or disc jockeys, who would take part in races. And these races they had a team of 12 identical Ford Escort Mexicos, which were specially set up for racing. And the drivers would do a bit of training, and then they would have very competitive races. And people like John Peel loved that, and Noel Edmonds, of course, did, and Dave Lee Travis, and some of the others. So it had grown out of that enthusiasm for racing that we then decided to sponsor a race called the Radio 1 Production Saloon Car Championship, because we thought the public could identify with production saloon cars, because they were fairly near road cars to look at. And I would get a Radio 1 disc jockey along at each round of the race. I think there were 12 rounds in the course of a year to present the award. So that was another good promotional tool for us. We had done this Radio 1 Fun Day at Brands Hatch, and we thought we would spread it further. The management of Brands Hatch were very pleased the way it had gone. We'd made a lot of money for charity from the profits. And so we decided to stage one at Mallory Park up near Leicester. Now, Mallory Park is slightly different from Brands Hatch, and the racing circuit goes around the outside of a lake. We did one roadshow in the morning, and people came in by the thousands. In fact, so many that the circuit was jammed. And the chief constable was there, and he called John Webb, the managing director of Brands Hatch, in, and me in, and said, "You're just so irresponsible, you two. You don't know what you've done." And I said, "Well, it's not really our fault, it's your fault for not putting enough police on." You know, he said there were 20,000 people jammed in the roads outside. Derek Jenner was one of them. He couldn't get to his own show. And so he said, when these Bay City Rollers arrive, there'll be a riot. I said, well, that's quite simple. I will cancel them, because I was flying them in by helicopter and I knew the pilot. I said, I'll call up and cancel. If you cancel them, there'll be a riot. I said, well, I'm not sure quite what we're going to do then. But what we decided to do was, instead of bringing them onto the road show parked on the outside of the track, there was an island in the middle of this lake. So I phoned Mike Barrett, the pilot, and said, look, when you bring the rollers in, land them on the island in the middle of the lake, which he duly did. But of course, there was a race going on at the same time. So these cars were whipping around 100 miles an hour plus on the outside. And these roller fans, they were absolute maniacs. They rushed across the track. God knows how none of them were killed. Jumped in the water like lemmings and started to wade and swim towards the island where the rollers were. And I can remember this day, you know, people like Noddy Holder and the Three Degrees and others all just being totally ignored by these fans who were just trying every way to get to the rollers.
Amazing scenes going on here this afternoon, as you can no doubt hear, partly going on behind us since the rollers have been here. We have a little river surrounding, two various parts of the track here, and the girls are actually swimming across the river to try and get at their idols.
And I just was horrified. I mean, very, very worried. I really thought I was going to be fired. I thought kids would be killed. I was lucky. I think there was one child with a sprained ankle, and that was the only thing, but my wife and I were dragging them out of the water and laying them on the bank on the side there. They were sobbing and crying. It was mass hysteria, and it was just awful. I think the rollers were a bit surprised too. And David Hamilton, to his credit, was the broadcaster, and he had to carry on sort of presenting from the island in the middle via a radio mic to somebody else who was playing the records back on the roadshow stage, which was on the other side of the racetrack. It was a good performance, and he did well with it, but it was a terribly frightening moment, and I think I was amazingly lucky to get away with it, and we were lucky that nobody was killed. And it gave me a big fear of, you know, in the light of what happened at Hillsborough and other places, you can see how big crowds can get out of control. It's something I've always been very conscious of. It taught me a lesson, and I was very frightened.
Thank you very much indeed. Welcome to the Radio 1 Fun Day Out from a very congested Mallory Park.
They had a selection board. I can't remember all the people that were on it. Everything in the BBC was done by selection board. We had a couple of governors, and Chinnery called me in a couple of days later and said, well, congratulations, you've got the job. And to give Derek his due, he let me take over probably 3 or 4 months before I was actually officially appointed, so I was able to start making decisions. What I thought was that we needed more people who were perhaps a bit more mature in their approach, you know, less frivolous and more enthusiastic about the music. I mean, people like Simon Mayer, Nicky Campbell, Mark Goodyear, they sort of epitomised what I thought a lot of it was about. Roger Scott later on, when I persuaded him to come. It needed to grow up musically. And there's this old BBC thing about news and social action broadcasting and things like that. Yeah, I can remember having all these plans and being so enthusiastic and incited about starting it all, and suddenly you realise you're in charge of this biggest radio station in the world, and it's your toy to play with and do as you like with. I was very lucky when David Hatch became managing director of BBC Radio. He was the most supportive boss you could have. David was one from whom I learned a lot of lessons, one of which was personal praise and compliments or criticism to people. He would always be writing handwritten notes, some of them were illegible, but he would always drop people a note about something they'd done that was good or bad. And it was a habit that I followed when I was boss, and it was much appreciated. Came back to me again the other day, the note I got from Paul Gambaccini saying, God, it is so different now to what it was in your day. People who cared about the programmes and complimented you if you did something good. I mean, these guys have all got egos the size of a castle, haven't they? And they all expect you to have heard their programmes. And I don't know, it was little things like remembering when their wedding anniversaries were, when their birthdays were, taking them out for lunch, keeping them on side, trying to make sure. I mean, we had thought when commercial radio started, they'd be giving away a Cortina every breakfast time. I know we signed a number of the ones that we wanted for 2-year sort of golden gloves handshakes, really, so that they couldn't walk away because we were feared that we'd be poached. We couldn't pay them that much money, not by today's standards. I mean, they were earning good money, but even I wasn't earning good money compared to what controllers get these days. Yes, it was a very different culture, but you made people feel loved and wanted. You tried to listen to their programs. You tried to offer constructive criticism. And I mean, one of the people who was in for the least popularity stakes with the other DJs was Simon Bates, you know, because Simon's a very complex character. But I have to say, in his defense and mine, because I was pretty friendly with him, that he came up with more ideas per week than any other person on the station. He was always bombarding me with ideas. Why don't we do this? Why don't we go to Iraq when the war starts? Why don't we do so and so? Why don't we go to New York and do some programs from there? And he was always full of ideas, and not necessarily always for him to execute, you know, ideas for other people too. They were so imaginative. I mean, we had some wonderful producers there. Jonathan Ruffell was one.
As far as we're concerned, from New York, that does wrap it up. We've got one song to play. There's no particular significance other than maybe the words fit to the mood of the day. Don't forget on...
I think Savile was probably the only one that didn't really mix and associate with the others. And I'm quite proud of the fact that I got rid of Jimmy Savile, not for his predilections to young girls or boys or whatever, because I always thought he was rather asexual, but I thought his program was very boring. And when I took over as controller, I thought, this is not really the sort of thing I want Radio 1 to be about. So I gave him his notice.
Playing the oldies, National Radio 1.
Yeah, talking about payola and what have you, I think a lot of lessons were learned from the exposure in the News of the World back in the early days of Radio 1, when they had plastered us across the headlines of that paper from people attending various parties of a dubious nature and what have you. And they set up two reporters as fake promoters of some kind who were trying to get their records played. So after that, I mean, of course, there was lots of plugging lunches and things like that. Oh yeah, of course, every promoter. I mean, when you think there was something like 60 singles a week coming out and probably 30 or 40 albums, incredible. And then there would be a publisher promoter as well as a record company promoter for most of those tracks, so there's an incredible amount of pressure on getting onto the playlist. Or when we were at different stages, we went through having a playlist, then not having a playlist. I mean, it's rather silly when you think about it, that you have a team of producers producing daily shows, and each one's listening and saying, these are the records I want to repeat this week, and then somebody else having doing the same thing again. So it was common sense, really, to have a meeting of producers and agree on a broad list, which wasn't as heavily implemented as it is these days, you know, in the sense that there was still freedom of choice for producers to pick album tracks or oldies or particular singles that they wanted to make record of the week and that type of thing.
Have a happy day on Capital Radio.
This is an interesting story. Aidan Dave was one of my close friends, and he was running Capital Radio, and he had managed to get a thing called the Capital Cruiser, which was their promotional vehicle, and it was very deluxe and very glamorous and what have you. And he said, I'll bring it down to the back of the Beeb one day and we'll have a drink in there because I've got a bar. And I said, oh, that'd be nice. So he brought it down, and I took one or two of my producers, and we were all in there having a little bit of a glass of sherbet. Who should come along but Derek Chinnery, and saw us through the window. And he went mad. He phoned John Whitney, who also went mad, phoned Aidan Day. And there was a huge ruckus about it, for fraternising with the enemy. And I can just remember when Virgin Radio was going to start, Steve Wright came up with some scheme to start a fire in Egton House to divert attention, rather like the Grace Archer story, but...
Grace!
We were forbidden to do that, because I think this was by the time Liz Faulkner had taken over as managing director. Now, she had a very strange approach. I talked earlier about David Hatch having a very much a hands-on policy. In fact, David was almost too hands-on. If you wanted to move a disc jockey from one slot to another, you had to persuade him why you should do it. You even had to ask David Hatch if he wanted to use the F-word on the air, and that wasn't allowed very much. Anyway, Liz Forgan was brought in around the time of John Burt, and she took over as managing director, and she was the total opposite. Controller's job to control, not my business. For instance, over the problem with Dave Lee Travis, who would have been much better suited to Radio 2, she wouldn't interfere, she wouldn't dictate to Francis Lyne, the then controller, that she should take Dave Lee Travis. No, if she doesn't want Dave, then he'll have to go, or whatever. Well, we know what the result of that was. They've more or less fired himself.
Quack, quack.
Oops. Changes are being made here that go against my principles, and I just cannot agree with them.
Yeah, I think I was at home with a tummy bug or something when Jeff Simpson, who was our press officer, called me and said, Dave's left. I said, what do you mean he's left? Well, he's announced his resignation on the air. So I called him. I said, well, you don't leave me any alternative. We didn't fall out about it. He knew by doing that I had no choice but to get rid of him, because he'd had some sort of sound off on the air a couple of days before, I think, on this Saturday show. And I'd given him a sort of fairly heavy warning then that if we were to do it again, he'd have to go. And he'd given an undertaking not to. And then he went and gave an interview to Piers Morgan, and that was the consequence of it.
Doggone crazy days.
But we didn't just have a laugh on the pub. Sometimes we championed things that needed championing.
We did.
It took 20 years, you know, to get an FM network. That shows some indication of how much faith they did or didn't have in. I mean, they're all excuses about there wasn't enough space on the waveband and all the rest of it, but it was all very sad. I mean, by then we had got to 24 hours a day, and we'd got total separation, and we'd got FM coverage, but you know, the fact that it took 20 years to achieve that, one of the network that was the highest listening network. You see, there was a problem, wasn't there? David Hatch charged me with getting the biggest audiences, because the justification for the licence fee was that most people at some time are using one of the BBC services, and if that was Radio 1, that was fine. Well, when John Burt came in, he wanted something different. He was worried about the renewal of the charter, and wanted to make sure that Radio 1 was distinctive and different from the opposition. Well, I pointed out that it was distinctive and different in the fact that I extended the evening news beat to 30 minutes. We were doing more news, more people hearing their news via Radio 1 than any other network. We were doing social action broadcasting. I had, at his request, introduced comedy on Radio 1 with Victor Lewis Smith, which was very daring stuff. And you know, the Now show on Radio 4, that started out as the Mary Whitehouse Experience, and that was another one that I'd commissioned.
The Mary Whitehouse Experience!
And we were also doing more concerts, because I thought young people, particularly the time of high unemployment and what have you, couldn't afford the high fees to go, so we should be broadcasting more live concerts. And we did a couple of summers where we did dozens of live shows by all sorts of people. Michael Jackson, and I put up a warning notice in the studio saying, one thought, one link, and I'm trying to keep it short. Some wag wrote on the back of it, you'll be lucky. I don't know if it meant lucky because they didn't have more than one thought, or whether I was, you know, just taking the mickey out. Well, the best thing, I suppose, is the sense of comradeship you get. I mean, you do make an incredible number of friends over the years with different things, and I'm still friendly with a lot of them. In fact, we have a group which might interest you called the Former Heads of Radio, and we have a lunch in the summer and a lunch in the... We used to be a dinner in the evening, but everybody's getting older now, so it's a lunch. And used to be about 50 members when I first joined it. We only invite people that were nice, you know, so... All sorts of old folk, like Aubrey Singer was a member. But of course, the group, by definition, gets smaller because we keep dying off, and so it gets fewer and fewer. I think there are about 25 or 30 regulars. So that's the best thing. The worst thing about it, I suppose, is the bureaucracy. I mean, I quite admire Tony Hall for slimming it down. I'm not sure about his ideas for running three directorates instead of and muddling up television and radio, because... You know, I suspect the fear about that is that radio will lose out again. Television takes all the money, and then radio's left with very little. But I always had, you know, in the old days, commercial radio, I had a very good relationship with Alan Chalfont and Peter Baldwin when they were running the Radio Authority, and I had a lot of respect for the way in which they structured it. In there couldn't be the same format in any area, you know, and I thought that was super. You could have a country station and a MOR station or a pop station and what have you. And nowadays, under Ofcom, as we know, everything is just muddled up, and it's led to a sort of blandness about the whole thing and a lack of originality in presenters. Where are the new Kenny Everetts coming from? You know, it's a shame, isn't it? Chris Moyles, I suppose, is pretty original. He used to like the sound of his own voice too much, but I mean, he is an original thinker. But there isn't much room for originality in commercial radio these days, is there? I don't know. I'd like to go down as somebody who entertained an awful lot of people in their youth, and we have a Radio 1 group on Facebook of people who are enthusiastic, and they do write some nice things, and it's nice to see the appreciation that I get. The larger member is a fair boss who tried to do something to increase the opportunities for women in broadcasting. I did bring in quite a lot of women, you know, in the time, and I tried to make it not quite as frivolous as it was when it started.